homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning, friends. So we're going to explore impermanence together this morning. I think this is at least the fourth Dharma talk I'll have given on this subject, and our other teachers have also given many. So what's so special about impermanence to warrant so many Dharma talks? Well, I hope in today's talk to take the Dharma of impermanence beyond theory and philosophy and present a view that's beyond thought, that moves us towards actively living impermanence. But first, we'll go into a little background material. Impermanence, or anicca, the Pali word, is usually considered to be one of the most foundational teachings in our vast collection of Buddhist Dharma. A basic definition of impermanence is that all conditioned things, and that means all phenomena, humans, animals, thoughts, trees, washing machines, emotions, and so forth, are in a constant state of flux. All physical and mental events, all beings, all phenomena, come into being and dissolve in every moment. Not entirely, to be sure, but enough that the interconnected, mutually dependent universe is different in every moment, flowing moment to moment. And closely related to this, all phenomena, all beings, both animate and inanimate, are conditioned by and interconnected with all beings. And all beings, again, includes everything. All phenomena, every single thing, whether animate or inanimate, sentient or insentient, everything within the relative universe. In a sense, we and everything else are defined by the interplay of all beings. If any one of these beings is in flux, then all beings must be in flux. And conversely, if all beings are in flux, transient, then each of us is transient too. And this doesn't just mean that someday we'll die. It means that we die as a static defined being in every moment and are born as a slightly new being in every moment. The self of the last moment seems to have some influence over how we're reborn, for better or worse. But it's also true that everything has some influence over how we're reborn. Jiyu Kennett, the founder of Shasta Abbey and in our direct lineage line, Jiyu Kennett offered this about anicca in Zen as Eternal Life. She said, all things change, all life grows old, decays, being ever-changing. This includes the total separation of all moments from one another, leading ultimately to the void of the scripture of great wisdom, the Heart Sutra that we just chanted, and Dogen's Uji. Dainen Katagiri, in his book, Each Moment is the Universe, which, by the way, I highly recommend if you want to follow up on this topic of impermanence, which I point out that you can't help but do. Dainen Katagiri wrote, Buddha taught that everyone has the capability to go beyond the ordinary mind, ordinary body and mind, and be fully present in impermanence with the whole body and mind. Then ignorance, desire, and suffering all disappear. And also from that book, he said, you already exist in the domain of impermanence, together with everyone and everything in the cosmic universe. As a human being, you inherently have a great capability that enables you to realize this truth and to experience your life with deep joy. I'd add to that statement that though we have that great capability to realize the truth of impermanence, it takes some conscious effort and a whole lot of acceptance on our part to bring impermanence into our everyday awareness. Elsewhere in his book, Katagiri tells us, change is the basis of human life. Just live right in the middle of the flow of change, where there is nothing to hold on to. How do you do this? Just be present and devote yourself to doing something. This is a simple practice of Zen. All this language I'm putting out to you, by the way, I encourage you to feel it. Not so much think about it, but feel it. Impermanence is closely related to the Four Noble Truths. We're told that the Four Noble Truths was the first teaching of the Buddha after his enlightenment. And for those of you who are fairly new to Buddhist practice, I'll briefly summarize the teaching. The First Noble Truth states that human existence involves dukkha. And dukkha is the Pali word for all the variations on personal suffering, such as grief, anger, fear, depression, general dissatisfactoriness, and so forth. And we often use the word suffering to stand in for all of these variations. I'm going to be pretty loose about exchanging Pali words and English words as we go through this. Dukkha is suffering, impermanence is anicca, and so on. The second noble truth is that the cause of dukkha is craving or clinging. We'll come back to that shortly. The third noble truth is that there's a way to end dukkha. Cessation of the cause of dukkha is possible. Nirvana is possible. And the fourth noble truth describes the path that brings nirvana forward, the Eightfold Path. The experiential, intuitive understanding of impermanence and no self is often considered to be a main ingredient of the first step of the Eightfold Path, right view or right understanding. What do we crave? We crave permanence in our existence. And we crave not to experience the loss of what we think is ours, our stuff, our possessions, family and friends, our health, our sense of self, our very lives. And we also crave in an aversive way, I don't want this, whatever unpleasant phenomenon it is. If only I didn't have this rotten boss, or rotten partner, or rotten me, or seemingly endless zazen period, or achy knees, or whatever you'd like to add to your basket of unpleasantness. If only I didn't have those, I'd be happy. And yet we do have them. And as a result, we do have dukkha. Impermanence is also included as one of the three marks or three characteristics of existence. These are also sometimes called the three Dharma seals. And they're typically taught as dukkha, which we've been talking about, suffering, anicca, which is impermanence, and anatta, which is no self or not self. And it's important to note that though anicca and anatta, impermanence and no self, though they're generally taught as separate concepts, they're not separate realities. Understanding and opening to either is understanding and opening to both. Either one includes the other. Looking at it logically, if everything is transient and permanent, and you are affected by everything, how can you be a static, permanent self? So consider anicca and anatta as separate glimpses of the same truth, the same awareness, flow, universal flow. How does impermanence explain suffering and no self? Suffering, we're taught, is caused by craving permanence. And as I mentioned earlier, this goes in two directions, craving the continued existence of what brings us a sense of well-being or pleasure, and craving to get rid of what we think brings us dukkha. Both grasp for a permanently satisfying now. A permanently satisfying now can't survive in impermanence. No self is a recognition that we consist of nothing permanent. We have no fixed, unchanging characteristics. This follows from an understanding of impermanence. If everything, everywhere, every now is changing, how can there be an unchanging static self? For a scientific perspective on impermanence, I asked Google's AI, how many human cells die every second in an average adult? And the answer was Between 1 and 4 million cells die every second, with recent research indicating it's at the higher end of that scale. At about 3.8 million cells in your body dying every second, or about 330 billion cells in your body dying daily. And that's just the human cells. It doesn't include the billions of non-human organisms that live in us, in our microbiome, which include bacteria, viruses, fungi, and other microorganisms that also die in every second. And Google reassures us that this high rate of cell turnover is a healthy natural process necessary for renewal, clearing old cells and preventing disease. Which I kind of like that. I mean, it fits in pretty well with our Dharma here. What complex, continuously changing beings we are. And yet, I think most of us tend to ignore impermanence or reduce it to being a mere conceptual theory or philosophy for much of our lives. Speaking for myself, I had zero interest in impermanence as a teaching when I was young. It seemed irrelevant when I was at the peak of my physical and mental abilities. Those abilities appeared to me to be pretty dependable and permanent in my 20s and 30s. And it wasn't until my 40s, I think, that I started noticing some diminishing of my abilities, along with an increase in my questioning who I was. It wasn't until about my 60s that I started understanding that there was something of importance to be learned in impermanence. And not until I was entering my 70s that I really accepted impermanence as central to my practice. But I think I'm a fairly slow learner, and I think many of you can probably do a lot better.
No.
Slow is okay. One more observation. I think many of us, and this has definitely been true of me in the past, many of us believe the misconception that impermanence is only relevant when we're dying. And that's so wrong. Every moment of our lives is impermanent. Every moment, every slice of a moment is change. It's happening here right now, and we can know that for ourselves right now. It benefits our practice, our lives, when we learn to directly include impermanence in our awareness. Okay, that's enough for background, I think. Let's move on to exploring more deeply why we might include impermanence in our practice. And I'd like to start with a very brief exercise. I invite you to ask yourself, and I'll give you some time to process this, not a lot of time. I invite you to ask yourself, am I willing to change? Right now, am I willing to change? And a variation on this question might be, am I completely open to the next moment? So choose whichever of those two variations most resonates for you, and feel what comes up for you as you ask the question. Does the question move you towards a feeling of lightness or towards heaviness? Does fear arise, or does some sense of expansion arise? Or perhaps both? And I'll pause now for about a minute for you to consider that question. Am I willing to change? Or if you'd rather, am I open to the next moment? Start a pause. Okay, there's some range in how willing we are to change, but if you're near or at the extreme static end of this range with a loud no, I don't want to change, then you're stuck trying to stay where you are while the universe churns along around you. And that very stuckness causes dukkha. Feel that if that's true for you. Resisting impermanence, grasping at an illusory static beingness, is the very definition of the first and second noble truths. And by the way, resisting impermanence has no effect on impermanence itself. Impermanence rules. Your resistance mostly affects you, the resistor, and usually not for the better. Impermanence can appear in our lives as liberation if we're in accord with it, if we consciously flow in it. But impermanence appears as dukkha if we resist it or forget it. And why do I say it's dukkha if we forget it? Because for most of us, in the absence of awareness of the changing me in the changing moment, all our dualistic habit energy of thought, speech, and action is more than strong enough to grab most of our consciousness as a separate self and maintain us in that state of dukkha. That question, am I willing to change, calls to my mind our third bodhisattva vow, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Both resonate in the same place in my heart and work to open me to the constant movement of impermanence. Moving in accord with impermanence means change. Life may on the surface get better or worse, but grasping on to no change is a dead end. That ultimately translates into creating and concretizing our dukkha. Shinryu Suzuki, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, said this about anicca, impermanence. The basic teaching of Buddhism is the teaching of transience or change. That everything changes is the basic truth for each existence. No one can deny this truth, and all the teaching of Buddhism is condensed within it. Wherever we go, this teaching is true. This teaching is also understood as the teaching of selflessness. Because each existence is in constant change, there is no abiding self. In fact, the self nature of each existence is nothing but change itself. This is also called the teaching of nirvana. When we realize the everlasting truth of everything changes and find our composure in it, we find ourselves in nirvana. And that's from his second collection of Dharma talks, Not Always So. And near the top of my list of favorite Buddhist quotations is another Shinryu Suzuki teaching in Not Always So that I think is very relevant to what? I think it's very relevant to how we can begin to welcome impermanence into our lives. And I bring out this quote fairly often, so I offer a tiny apology if you're sick of hearing it. Speaking from the perspective of a Zen master grappling with the task of how to teach Dharma, Suzuki said, "I feel sorry that I cannot help you very much, but the way to study true Zen is not verbal. Just open yourself and give up everything. Whatever happens, whether you think it is good or bad, study closely and see what you find out. This is the fundamental attitude. This is what it means to surrender, even though you have nothing to surrender. Without losing yourself by sticking to a particular rule or understanding, keep finding yourself moment after moment. This is the only thing for you to do." I find that to be such a clear description of our practice, meeting each moment with openness and curiosity and adding nothing extra to it. If you like that quote and would like it, I brought along some copies, you can pick them up afterwards. I'd also add to my A-list of favorite quotations that coax an openness to impermanence, much of the precious mirror samadhi which we just chanted together. Some lines that speak to the why and how of impermanence. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. Penetrate the source and travel the pathways. Embrace the territory and treasure the roads. A little commentary on that. There is no destination in our practice. There's only path, and that's enough. More from the precious mirror samadhi. Within causes and conditions, time and season, it is serene and illuminating. Mastered or not, reality constantly flows. And it finishes with this, just to do this continuously is called the host within the host. I'll sum up my claim that there is great value in experientially exploring impermanence with this quote from Kyogen, in his pamphlet Zen Roots. Kyogen, by the way, was the original abbot of our center here, came down from the Geokenet lineage. He said, non-acceptance of Nietzsche, the fact that all things change, is where dukkha becomes suffering, as understood in the West. Non-acceptance of the fact that all things change is the real meaning of clinging or grasping, as the terms are used in the Second Noble Truth. The teaching of Nietzsche means that deep within us there is a place of utter freedom and integrity, untouched by anything. Coming to know this place is the purpose of training, and the teaching of Nietzsche is a way of pointing to it. Okay, I think I've thrown enough words at you to hint at the why of wholeheartedly practicing impermanence. Let's move on now to the how. How do we practice in accord with impermanence? How do we be impermanence? And I need to start with a disclaimer. The practice of being impermanence is an ongoing exploration for me. I'm in the midst of actively playing with this, investigating it, exploring it, and it's been very alive for me for a while now. So I treat this very much as a koan. Conceptualizing impermanence or time doesn't seem very helpful. I think it's actually counterproductive. I don't feel I have any final answers or that I know exactly what will help you explore being impermanence, but I think there may be some value in my sharing with you what's coming up for me in my practice with this. And my overall hope for this talk is that I nudge a few of you to experientially explore impermanence also. So I think most, maybe all of us, typically think, act, and move as a relatively stable or static self in a three-dimensional spatial framework. For instance, I'm Gyoshi here in the Zendo giving a Dharma talk on impermanence. The temporal dimension, time, is always operating, but we're typically minimally conscious of it. But we're very conscious of being a separate individual self, a self separate from everything outside our own bag of skin, a self that's fairly recognizable to others and ourselves over time. We may be conscious of the passage of time or the pressure of time, for instance, getting to the Zen center in time, finishing a task by the required time, using our time, quote, wisely, and so forth. To some degree, that's useful when navigating the relative world. But actually living whole-mindedly, whole-bodily, wholeheartedly in all four dimensions, with continual change or impermanence having as much a part in our aware presence as length, width, and depth, that can be transformational. And we can still get the dishes washed. I offer another observation on the value of deeply allowing impermanence into our consciousness. You may find, as I do, that this can add a lot of energy and depth into your practice of Zazen and mindfulness. For some, anatta, no self, may offer an easier way into the practice of impermanence than impermanence itself offers. As I pointed out earlier, anatta is impermanence as applied to our sense of a stable self. No self may be just as difficult to accept as impermanence, but I find that my sense of self has become a lot more flimsy over time without my consciously trying to make that so. I think it's due both to aging and practice, the natural result of both working together. Many people, if they consciously meet impermanence at all, do it solely on a rather self-centered, superficial level, savoring the reassurance that their dukkha won't last forever. A hidden agenda, and by that I mean an agenda that we hide from our ongoing awareness, a hidden agenda to maintain our separate self in the midst of our suffering may drive this. We may subtly hold on to a flawed me, my, mine, mantra of I will survive and surmount this. I, me, will surmount this. I'm tough. But if we're truly in sync with impermanence, if we fully allow impermanence in our consciousness, we, as separate, static, identifiable selves, don't survive it. This is where impermanence meets not self. And to my mind, it's very good news. I think it's easiest and least threatening to see impermanence on a macro level. Seasons, long periods of time, a lifetime. But it's difficult, but I think most transformative, to know impermanence on the micro moment-to-moment level. That's what leads us to open, accepting, living in now. On this deeper micro level, nothing lasts for more than this moment. Everything is new with the next moment. The universe is changed in each small fraction of a moment. Dogen affirms this in Uji. Modern physics affirms this. And it's true whether or not we notice it. Again, from the precious mirror samadhi, mastered or not, reality constantly flows. This doesn't deny some continuity through time. We can usually remember to finish the sentence that we started, pay our bills on time, get here in time to do what we need to do. But there's an aliveness, a flow that's happening and that we can relax our way into. It's here right now for us if we don't resist it. Now I'll suggest some ways you might find your way into practicing an impermanence and no self. As I mentioned earlier, and I think as both Kyogen and Jiyu Kennett reminded us, our practice of shikantaza, just sitting, is sitting as impermanence. But it helps to notice that and bring it forward into our awake awareness. Kinhin, our walking meditations, is also an excellent medium for knowing impermanence. Or for that matter, any movement, as long as it's free, open, and aware. Quoting Katagiri again, where he comments on Dogen's Uji, which, by the way, the translation is usually being time or the time being. So Katagiri said this: there's no way to know impermanence empirically, because impermanence is not something you can understand with your cognition, feelings, emotions, or consciousness. So how can we exist? How can we take care of daily living right in the middle of the dynamic stream of time? This is the point Dogen really wants to make. Dogen doesn't want impermanence to be just an idea. He wants us to put the real nature of time into practice in our daily life. Buddhism is really hard, particularly Dogen's teaching. He gives you a very hard practice. Keep your mouth shut and look directly at impermanence. This living practice is called Zazen. Zazen is not a way to escape from life by being mindful of something that is apart from the human world. It is the practice of being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself. If you find yourself lost in distractions, and we're moving along here in different ways, you might gain some access to the experiential awareness of impermanence. So if you find yourself lost in distractions, you could use a mantra to remind you to notice and accept impermanence. For example, be here now. Include everything. Awake. There's only stream. That, by the way, is from a book by Steve Hagen, which is also the same lineage as Katagiri Roshi. Buddhism is not what you think is the name of the book. And the whole passage is, it's not that the universe is made up of innumerable objects in flux. There's only flux. Nothing is or can be riding along in the flux like a cork in the stream. Nothing actually arises or passes away. There's only stream. I think a lot of us do tend to imagine ourselves as that cork in the stream. And this is trying to put a skewer through that. No, because that's still a separate being. Going on with these possible mantras, Our third bodhisattva vow, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. And the Heart Sutra's concluding verse that we just chanted, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisvaha. Jiyukanit's translation, going, going, going on beyond, always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Continuous, impermanent flow. Or you can come up with your own mantras that remind you to be present in impermanence. You might also try in your zazen some focused awareness of obviously flowing phenomena such as breath, sounds, body feelings, thoughts. Thoughts as a thought, not as the content of a thought. Letting your mind move with the impermanence of those phenomena. When deeply settled in zazen, already still, invite in change itself as your soft object of meditation. Pay attention to your changing self. I'll quote Tara Brach on this. She said, when we go deeper on our spiritual path, this reflection on the truth of impermanence becomes increasingly central. The only way that we can really wake up is to open to the reality that it's all changing. We learn to recognize the trance of self and permanence. We wake up from the limited story of who we are. We learn to rest in the timeless, loving awareness of impermanence. And another impermanence practice strategy that I love is sitting zazen alongside a rushing stream. Some might find it helpful to contemplate the great mystery of birth and death. And I see this as one of the great gifts of aging, how easy it is to see ourselves physically changing and dying and being born bit by bit. Note that we can't practice an impermanence solely through effort. Thinking our way into an awareness of impermanence doesn't seem to work either. But accepting it, this changing present moment, letting go into it, makes impermanence available. And this, I think, is an aspect of practice that over time requires less and less effort and more acceptance. You also might start your deeper relationship with impermanence by intimately knowing what life feels like when you live it grasping at permanence, or reflexively maintaining your sense of being a separate self. If you find stillness and pay attention to that, you may feel it as tight, fearful, or defensive. Your sense of these may be subdued amidst the busyness and habitual nature of daily life. But if you actively know your dukkha, you can feel this tightness or fearfulness or defensiveness and grow from that. So in conclusion, do you know what your life feels like when you're not grasping at permanence? I encourage you all to find out. Over time, you can learn to soften and relax into the stream of impermanence, becoming the stream of impermanence, responding fully to whatever you meet in each moment. And if we allow ourselves congruence with impermanence, if we don't fight it, assume it away, make it simply a thought or a philosophy or a science, or resist it in any other clever way, then we allow the absolute into our lives. And that's my Dharma talk. I welcome your questions or comments now.
Hi, if you are in the Zendo, just raise your hand and I will come to you. Say your name first and hold the microphone up to your mouth so that we can hear. And if you are in the Zoom room, please either raise your hand or type in the chat and Hannah will either read out your question or unmute you for that.
And give me a moment while I put on something so I can hear your questions. Mm-hmm.
This is Dinan. I really appreciated the viewpoint, and being almost 76 now, you know, a lot of what you had to say resonated a lot, and perhaps to paraphrase a quote and mangle it a little bit, the recognition of impermanence has a tendency to help focus the mind. But the one thing I want to comment about was one of the things that I found in accepting it, and your question of are you willing to change and be open to those things, is that with impermanence just being, there's a relaxation that occurs. And I don't necessarily want to say happiness, but there's this sort of warm understanding of, you know, that you can deal with things that come up and let them go, and you can focus or not, and it doesn't have to be any particular way. And for me, I found a great deal of, avoiding angst of, well, you know, at 76, you know, you never know how much longer you have. But you just live it day to day, moment by moment, and find yourself being open to all the changes that occur or come in your way and be able to embrace them. And so I appreciate your talk. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for that. I would just add one thought to that, and that is, if we're talking about relaxing into impermanence and so on and being soft with what is also a very, or there can be a very electric aliveness that comes with that.
Hi, Yoshi. Thank you for your talk. My name is Guy. I noticed that you mentioned the one of the Bodhisattva vows, that the Dharma gates entering them, and I was thinking about that because I feel that there's kind of a tension there, in that when we make those very aspirational, those, you know, extraordinary vows that are impossible to fully fulfill, obviously, and that's the paradox in them, that I feel kind of creates a tension, especially maybe as we get older. If we really take those vows seriously, it seems to me that we're bound to reflect on, well, have we lived up to them? Are we leaving a legacy that reflects our commitment to those vows? And that could, I feel like that almost inevitably is going to create some possible angst, some possible maybe even regrets, maybe pain or misgivings or remorse. Did we, you know, leave a legacy that really reflects our commitments to those vows? So how does one reconcile that tension?
Let me ask you first, is that your experience, that you feel those things?
Definitely.
Okay. It's not my experience. My experience of, and I recite these every day, you know, first thing in the morning. My experience is that they remind me of what actually matters to me, what matters most. I'm not making myself let those things matter most, but making the world better for all beings, yeah. That matters to me. Not clouding my mind with delusions and then acting out of delusion, that matters to me. Entering every moment, that's how I read that third vow. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. It's kind of, you know, the metaphor of stepping off the 100-foot pole, same thing. And to me, there's a sense of joy about that. But I do need the reminder to live my life this way, because I want to live my life that way. And then the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. was telling somebody recently that my current version, I morph these vows to best express where I'm at. And my most recent morph of that fourth vow is the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to dance it. So anyway, does that get to your question?
I guess, but you know, in other words, you don't try to measure things by some objective standard as to whether or not you're closer or farther away from any destination.
No, I don't. I don't. I just, right now, what matters.
Thank you.
Sure.
Well, I have two, this is Genko. I have a couple of reactions that happened while you were speaking. One was the first one about how open am I to change? I found myself thinking, well, it depends. And how? And so that tells me that there's some resistance there, which is interesting. The open to the next moment, I don't have that feeling at all. But the thing about how willing am I to change is like there's definitely an I in there that's saying, wait a minute. So that's interesting. The other reaction I had was that when you were talking about the stream of time, I heard the scream of time. I even wrote it down because I thought, ooh, that's true. Eventually I figured out, oh no, that's not what he's talking about, but I think it's sort of good.
It's possible I misspoke, you know, or spoke right, you know.
Well, I guess what it brought up for me is that this is not easy. This is hard. One of the things I often say to people who are grieving and who are having a difficult time with a loved one dying and or, you know, contemplating their own death is it doesn't make any sense. It makes no logical sense. And so it's really hard to wrap our heads around, right? Mm. And a lot of our practice is like that. But, you know, for people, particularly for people who are not practicing with it, it's kind of like, I don't even know what to do with this. And that's, I find that in myself, that there's like these things that come up and I'm like, wait a minute. And I have to just like find a way to let go of trying to be, figure it out. And I've spent a lot of my life trying to figure things out. And so, and I don't always know how to do that. So this is what sort of sitting still, and that's why I say I'm open to meeting the next moment. That's fine, because I think I'm always curious. I'm like, oh, this is cool. But trying to make any sense out of it, logical sense out of it, is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, all the writings about time, it's very, very hard, I think impossible, to think ourselves into understanding time. You know, and that's why I'm leaning heavily on the experiential.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, yeah. The scream of...
The scream of time.
Yeah, like that.
Thank you so much for the talk. My name's Becca. One of the things that I was really struck by is this idea of knowing yourself. I think for me, and I feel like culturally, we hold that in very high regard. Like knowing yourself is the thing that sort of steals you. Like it's a sign of well-being. It's this way that you navigate the world by knowing yourself and how to best get through things. And then holding that with the opposite of no self. So it's actually unknowable. And I'm wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit more about particularly that tension in this culture and in this context, when we're so accustomed to wanting to like know and have introspection, and like that's such a sign of emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, modern psychology would tell us it's a healthy way to live. I I think that is true, but we can do it a lot lighter than we normally do it. people depend, you know, they depended on a DOG to show up here to give today's Dharma talk because nobody else signed up to do it. But I think we can still just hold the lightness about that. There are times, if we're feeling really bad about ourselves, that reminding ourselves that we have some strength, that there is something in us that will arise to meet the next moment, that can be useful. The danger, I think, is creating an identity around it. Because then we spend a whole lot of energy, a lot of rigidity on trying to maintain that identity. And there's a joy in evolving. Does that get to it?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for your talk, Yoshi. This is Suho. And I was thinking about your talk, and I was thinking about Becca's comment of to know the self is to forget the self. Mm. And I think there's a different teaching there than the Western teaching of to know the self, because a lot of times that concretizes the self. I am like this in these conditions, which is super helpful. But to really know the self is to know that it changes and that it's impermanent. I think that's when we start to get the kind of traction that I think we want in our practice, and it relates to so many of the things that you talked about today.
Yeah. Do you have in mind the whole quote? Because I think that's relevant here.
To study the self is to know the self. To know the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is
actualized, but immediately.
And I'll just hand it to everybody else. And then the myriad things.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that. This is Kristen. I just wanted to briefly share my favorite metaphor on no self and impermanence. I'm sure people have heard it. A lot of people have heard it here billions of times. But it's basically equating like a being's life to being a wave in the ocean. Mm-hmm. How it's, if you think about the wave being a separate being from the ocean, it really doesn't make any sense at all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. That when I mentioned Zazen along a rushing stream, that's exactly what that does for me. Anything on Zoom?
It doesn't seem so.
Okay. Last call, going, going, going. Okay.